Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Mark Sarvis, the author of the award-winning novel Memento Park. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshiniot, Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport, and Ron Benicot. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. The latest Pew Research Center survey on religion in America came out just last week. It again shows that Judaism was ranked as the religion Americans liked the most, although 7 out of 10 Americans don't know Shabbat begins on Friday night. In other words, Americans generally have a very favorable view of Judaism and Jews. They just don't know much about it or us. They obviously have not been listening to the Two Jewish Radio Show often enough. Anyway, the questions on this new Pew survey should be mostly pretty easy to answer if you know anything about religion. Is Mecca the holiest place on earth for Muslims? What is transubstantiation in Christianity? Are Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur the high holy days for Jews? And so on. People who know the most about religion tend to have the most favorable impression of religious groups, including Jews and Buddhists and Muslims and Hindus. It turns out that atheists, Jews, and evangelical Christians scored the highest on knowledge of religion. Still, there were 32 multiple-choice questions on this survey, and most people could not correctly answer half of them. Not surprisingly, young Americans know the least about religion, including basic facts. Which brings up a problem. Contemporary Judaism faces a challenge in finding religious motivation for its people, that is, in making prayer and communal observances, you know, Shabbat services, into something that draw people in and motivate them. The truth is that while the Hasidic orthodoxy of Chabad has continued to grow and extend its tentacles, influence, into many new areas of Jewish identity, the mainstream Jewish movements, Reform, Conservative, even Reconstructionist Judaism, haven't really been able to retain the regular participation and commitment of members in recent years. This trend has been going on for decades, and in spite of the religious innovations introduced recently, it has not really changed. The same kind of problem exists for mainstream Protestant denominations in America, and for English-speaking Catholic churches too, by the way. They have experienced a national decline in attendance and involvement. In fact, while Americans remain the most religious of all modern nations by a good margin, the only groups that have experienced substantial growth in attendance and involvement, as opposed to declines, are Muslims and Hindus. But they are increasing from a very small base, relatively speaking. Evangelical Christian membership, identification, and involvement has been more or less stable over the past decade, but other groups have declined. For Jews, the challenge has been the erosion of what was once a steady commitment to attend and participate in Shabbat observance in the synagogue. For Reform Jews, this was typically Friday night. For Conservative and Reconstructionist Jews, this was Saturday morning. Those main services have retained some of their appeal, of course, but the notion that people will come to services every week has largely disappeared among younger generations. That means that instead of a more or less expected Shabbat congregation showing up regularly, each week becomes a kind of unique experience of a few regulars with whoever you happen to attract through special events, prominent guest speakers, new music, and so on. Synagogues today, on Friday and Saturday, are essentially competing with other forms of potential entertainment or activity. And mostly, they are not winning those competitions. What all of us, active in the world of Jewish ritual creation, that is, rabbis, cantors, and other synagogue leaders, What all of us end up being engaged in is a process of trying to create experiences that keep the buzz going, that bring people in the door. But the truth is, what actually grows congregations and adds meaning, purpose, and beauty to people's lives is not the latest speaker or the coolest melody, although these are nice. What draws people initially is the quality of the service itself and, to some degree, the appropriateness of the setting. And one more thing. A good cantor with a nice voice, an intelligent, sensitive rabbi who prepares and connects with his or her congregation, matter very much when people start attending. But what transforms a synagogue into a successful congregation is the atmosphere of caring, community, and joy that is established, the way in which people find a place in a group that offers them belonging and meaning. Of course, every congregation thinks that it's doing this successfully, but the truth is that most are too occupied with their own ego needs, either collectively or individually. You know, I am more important than you are. I matter more here than you do. Or our congregation is great and I don't want to admit we could do anything better or differently than with the real purpose of their community, prayer, study, religious action, and caring. I'm not sure if the Pew Research Center can find a way to quantify these values, which are at the heart of successful congregations and religious communities. But I do know that when we provide those real values in our synagogues, we don't need to worry about disturbing trends because we will, and do, bring people in with love and joy and real community. And those things never go out of style. To play us in this morning on the theme of Jewish community, here's a setting of the psalm verse Hinei Matov from past two Jewish guest Hillel Tagay. How good and pleasant it is for us to be here together in community. That was Hillel Tagay's Hinei Matov. Our guest this morning, Mark Sarvas, has written a moving and beautifully wrought novel about identity and history. It's called Memento Park, and it revolves around a mystery. Find out what that is, or don't, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Mark Sarvas, is the award-winning author of the novels Memento Park and Harry Revised. Memento Park won the American Jewish Library Association Fiction Award for this year. He was also a finalist for the Sammy Rohr Prize for Jewish Literature, shortlisted, well, a bunch of other awards as well. He lives in Los Angeles, and let's plunge right in. Actually, I shouldn't say that. You live in Santa Monica. That's not really Los Angeles, having grown up in L.A. I just want to share that with everybody.
Oh, great. You know it well, then.
I do, and went to UCLA, and I'm very Angelino, so I don't know if that helps or not.
Great.
Memento Park is, I think, a terrific novel. Tell us a little bit about how it evolved.
This is the one, and I've been doing a promotion for this book now for a couple of years, and this is, embarrassingly, this is always the one question that stymies me, because I've had this, I've carried the book around for so long that its origins are sort of lost in the mists of memory. I can't recall when and where and how I got the original idea for this novel. What I do know...
So I have to say, I mean, Sarvas is a Hungarian name. I'm assuming that there's a connection?
Yes. Sarvas in the original spell, which would have a Z after the first S, is a Hungarian name. I go by Sarvas, which is what my father changed it to when he came to America in 1956, because he didn't want to run around getting called Cesarvis all the time. So we've gone with the Americanized spelling and pronunciation. But it is Hungarian. Much of the book is set in Hungary. It is certainly, you know, has whiffs of autobiographical journey throughout the book. But when I wrote my first short story that got published back, I want to say in the very late 90s, the author bio for that story said that Mark is working on his first novel about looted Nazi art. And so I've had the idea for a long time, but I knew that when I came time to write my first novel, I didn't feel like I was a good enough writer, frankly, to write the book that I had envisioned. So I put this idea aside. I wrote Harry Revised, and then after that practice book, if you will, I returned to this idea. So it's been around for so long, I just don't remember anymore. I've looked in my journals, see if I could find the first mention of the idea, but it's lost without a trace.
How much of Matt Santos is you in the book?
Well, in the sort of particular details of his life, not a great deal. Matt is an actor, and I'm not, although as you know, living in L.A., you know a lot of actors, and so I've been exposed to that world, and I knew it well enough to write about it. There's also, sadly, no sort of multi-million dollar
art. I was saying that multi-million dollar, yeah, the painting that's not very beautiful, but it's worth millions. I'm sorry you didn't get it.
Yes, did not have one of those. Where I would say the book is sort of closest to truth is in the depiction between the relationship between Matt and his father, which is not unlike my relationship with my father, although my father it was both perhaps less monstrous than Matt's father can be and also less self-aware than Matt's father can be. and also with respect to Matt's journey around his lost Jewishness, that part also is pretty autobiographical. I was raised in a very secular post-war, you know, New York Jewish household where there was a Christmas tree. And so I ended up coming back to these ideas of my own Jewishness on my own and much later in life and in my sort of usual haphazard autodidactic fashion.
We will explore that and Memento Park much more with Mark Sarvas when we come back here in a moment on Two Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this summer and now moving towards the fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vital community and a vibrant one that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Congregation Beit Simcha is open to all throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, north of Ina, on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night at 7315 North Oracle Road. Shabbat evening services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. And next Friday night, Tat Kabbalat Shabbat at 5:30 p.m. for families with young children. A story, song, lots of great stuff. Join us for Shabbat at 7315 North Oracle Road on the west side of Oracle, just north of Ina. And for my Summer Adult Education Academy course, Talk About It, Gossip, Slander, and the Ethics of Speech on Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, and rich array of summer and fall Adult Education Academy courses, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Or BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona and its fastest growing during its exciting beginning year. We welcome back a randomly occurring two Jewish segment, Zen Judaism, Kohans, or Koans of Wisdom about our journey. Enter your inner self and behold the eye of the soul. Gaze upon your original face before you were born. Shocked? Remember, this was before the nose job. And end attachment. Take only what is given. Own nothing but your robes and an alms bowl. Unless, of course, you have the closet space. That was Zen Judaism, Koans of Wisdom on Too Jewish. If you have a question, compliment, comment, or criticism, a kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, TooJewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome Tom Price, our expert on the international Jewish scene. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So Bastille Day was not too long ago.
Right.
I've been thinking about the French Jewish community, which is an interesting amalgam of Jews from a lot of places, France, but also extensively from North Africa, from Eastern Europe originally. And I've just kind of wondered how that all works. It's one of the largest Jewish communities in Europe, if not the largest.
Right. I only have to preface my response by saying that I wish you hadn't mentioned Bastille Day, because in the current political context,
has that now become politicized as a one-way street?
Well, no, but the deal is the French have always had a military parade on Bastille Day.
I was there for one, actually.
It's a deeply seated part of their tradition of celebrating the one date that has come to symbolize sort of randomly the French Revolution and the birth of modern France. But we have not traditionally had military parades for the 4th of July.
No, that's absolutely right.
And this year there was at least an attempt to do so, and it was extremely controversial and left a bad taste in many people's mouths, particularly the mayor of D.C. So I sort of regret that you started off with a reference to Bastille Day, but now let me get to your question.
Okay.
So the French Jewish community is maybe the largest and most important in Europe, and it does consist of many elements. There are what people call French Jews, which basically means families that have been there since before the revolution. There's no such thing as a family that is Jewish and French for the last 2,000 years, the way there are such families in
Italy,
Iran and Iraq, right, and other places closer to Israel in some ways, or places where the exiles from Israel took place. But there are families that came at various points in the Middle Ages from various geographic origins. And certainly, even when France was a Roman province, there were some Jews there. There's old cemeteries and synagogues in the south of France, which was the most heavily Romanized part, that go back to the 5th and 6th centuries. So, yeah, there are, I mean, those Jews are called French Jews. I might think of them more accurately as Jewish subjects of Imperial Rome, but never mind. Okay. Then there were, after the Revolution, Jews who came to France because Jews were granted citizenship and equal rights and theoretically not discriminated against, and they came from places where that was far from the case, like Poland. So there's a whole community of Jews in France who came in the 19th century and in some cases early in the 20th century to work in the in coal mines. They were Polish miners. This is especially true in the very far north of France. So there's this big community of clearly Ashkenazic Jews with Polish last names that have been given French pronunciations, and it's sometimes very, very funny because you know what the real name is, but it's pronounced so differently in France, you have to actually see it in writing to figure it out. And then, much more recently, there's all the former French citizens from the North African countries that were part of the French Empire, and they deserve an episode to themselves.
We will talk about them next week. Fascinating. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rivka goes to see her rabbi, and she is very, very angry. She tells the rabbi she wants to divorce her husband. "Why?" asks the rabbi. "What's the matter?" And Rivka answers, "I have a strong suspicion that he's not the father of our child." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, our young representatives of Israel in the Weintraub Israel Center, Rotem Rapoport and Ron Benakot. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
This is kind of our last session for you guys. We'll have new Shin Shinim, I guess.
Yes.
Rotem, I'll start with you. What was the most challenging aspect of coming here for your Shnat Sherut, for your year of service here so far away from home?
So I think that the part that was I was struggling with most is missing home, and not just in a part of like missing my room, but like I'm like at the end of the day, I'm an 18-year-old girl who still live with her parents, who used to live 5 minutes away from her friends and used to be so not independent.
if we're being honest.
Yeah. I was so not independent when I got here. And I pulled myself out of there, threw myself in a new place, really independent, without anyone that I know but Ron, in a different culture, in a different country, on the other side of the world. I think that part of, like, missing the situation I was, because it was so like comfortable. Now I see that as like that was a smart thing to do, and of course I don't regret anything, but just like struggling with that change that I did to myself and like the gap that I needed to fill like by myself. That was like, I think, the hardest thing for me, at least at the beginning, like the hardest thing for me.
And Israeli culture is very inclusive. I mean, it's very close, right? Your family, friends, everybody's in everybody's business in Israel, right? It's
yes,
not
definitely.
Quite the same here.
Definitely.
Yeah. Actually, that was one of the parts that I liked more about American culture.
Not having that.
See, I was
a little more flexible, a little more freedom.
Yeah.
Not quite so
personal
much everybody
space,
telling
you
what
know.
To do.
Yeah.
It is different. It is different. Ron, what about you? What was the most challenging aspect of it for you?
So I think the most challenging thing for me was really overcoming those like cultural differences. especially like Rotem said, I mean, we both just got out of high school, and I used to like make my mom help me with everything that I do. So just like here trying to do it alone, sometimes I really didn't know how to do that, because that the cultures could be really different. If it's just like the language, or, you know, you guys use a lot more like emails here. Yeah. And I'm just used to like texting or calling or stuff like that.
That should be the biggest difference. We email and you guys text.
Yeah, wow, there's a lot of differences, so different. But like, or just like, I don't know, there's a lot of differences. And I remember that it was hard for me at first to understand exactly how to do it. And I also wanted to learn, you know, the American culture, and I was trying to get myself into that. And I,
you're assuming there is culture in America.
I think that I mean, like, I hope that now I kind of got it, and I'm happy that I got it. I learned something new.
Well, you guys have contributed so much. It's been a great pleasure having you here on Too Jewish, and
thank you so much for having us.
Want to keep hearing about what you do, and you go back.
I want to say thank you so much for letting us talk on the show and hosting us here. It's a really big part for my year, and we will remember it as a really good thing. It was great talking to you, and it was great.
Me too.
Yeah, it was a really nice experience, and I'm glad that you let us have it.
And you can always listen to yourselves
on
iTunes or on the
when I'll miss Tucson, I'm gonna
on TooJewishRadio.com. Just go up there and you can hear what's going on. Thank you so much, Lehitraot, and Siyat Tova. Safe trip back. A great success in the army and as you go forward.
Thank you so much for everything.
We'll miss you all.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye.
And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portions of Matot and Maaseh, the last sections of the Book of Numbers. Setting is the borders of the Promised Land as the Israelites approach Canaan for a second time after their 40 years sojourn in the wilderness of Sinai. As the tribes gather to enter the land, two of them, Reuben and Gad, make a strange request of Moses. We like the land we're traveling through now here on the east bank of the Jordan, in what is today the country of Jordan, by the way, long before Arab peoples moved into the Middle East. The leaders of these tribes, Reuben and Gad, say, "Let us stay here and build sheepfolds for our flocks and towns for our children." Moses agrees, but in very interesting language. First he tells them, "Build towns for your children, then build sheepfolds for your flocks." The message is clear. Families come first, our professions and income second. It's a human message, but one we need to be reminded of in every generation. There's another great human message in our doubled portions this week, but this one has to do with what happens when things go badly wrong. In the very last section of Numbers, called Maaseh, an important and unusual institution is created, the City of Refuge. In the days before police forces and criminal courts were common, justice in cases of manslaughter or murder was accomplished by the family of the victim. That meant that vigilante action was the normal means to address the moral and social disruption created by killing. If you killed someone, intentionally or accidentally, or even if the family of a person who was killed just thought you'd committed the killing, you would likely be killed by their kinsmen. That meant that if you were involved in such a terrible situation, you had very little chance to remain alive, even if the killing was accidental, even if you were innocent. The wheels of justice might turn for you eventually, but if you were already dead in a revenge killing, that wouldn't help much. This kind of reprisal killing also could and did lead to a cycle of revenge, the sort of blood feud Mark Twain captured in describing the Hatfields and McCoys in Huckleberry Finn several millennia later. And so, in the portion of Maaseh, the Torah provides for six cities of refuge to be created in and around the land of Israel. No person who enters these cities may be executed without a fair trial. Being present in the City of Refuge is a kind of protection, guarantee of due process that has become central in modern law but was mostly absent throughout human history. Yet the Torah established that principle 3,000 years ago. Perhaps even more importantly, it is in this section of Maaseh that the central requirement for a capital case in Jewish law is established. A murderer may not be put to death save by the eyewitness testimony of two adult witnesses. This is a much more stringent standard than used by any death penalty court in America today. Murder, the deliberate taking of human life, is the most serious crime and must be fully punished. But the Torah outmaneuvered the use of lynch mobs by creating cities of refuge. Under Jewish law, proper witnesses must be secured to give evidence, and a trial of law before judges is instituted before any punishment for murder can be applied. Judaism makes it clear that justice, especially for the worst crimes, has to be careful, exacting, and scrupulously ethical, a standard we would do well to establish in our own contemporary American courts. Our guest this morning, Mark Sarvas, tells a mysterious and powerful tale about art, memory, history, and identity in his great novel, Memento Park. Find out why it's so fascinating when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A bill to enshrine the right of Californians to hang mezuzahs on their door frames is moving through the state legislature and is on its way to the desk of Governor Gavin Newsom. California State Bill 652 will bar landlords and condo associations from prohibiting the display of religious items of a certain size on doors and door frames. Known as the Mezuzah Bill, although it has the support of secular organizations as well as Catholic and Hindu groups, it is sailing through the State House in Sacramento, passed the Assembly 72-0 July 8th after being approved by the Senate back on May 6th. The bill was introduced in February by all seven state senators on the 16-member California Legislative Jewish Caucus, including Democrats Steve Glazer, Scott Wiener, and Ben Allen. The bill has the strong backing of JPAC, the Jewish Public Affairs Committee, and the ADL, which last month sent a letter of support to the chair of the Assembly's Judiciary Committee, Representative Mark Stone. For millennia, Jews have posted mezuzahs on the entry of doorframes of their homes in fulfillment of a religious obligation rooted in the Torah, says the ADL letter. Posting a mezuzah is not a decorative choice for Jews, or indeed a choice of any kind. Five other states, Connecticut, Florida, Illinois, Rhode Island, and Texas, already have similar laws in place. Mayor Messenger Lang, a 33-year-old tech entrepreneur, said he was stunned when, soon after moving into an apartment with his wife in Mountain View, California, he was told by a property manager that their mezuzah violated the apartment complex's policy on exterior door decorations. Lang, a native Venezuelan with an aeronautics degree from Stanford, said the property manager told him, "That's a very nice ornament, but it has to come down." He was told nothing can be on the door at the brand new upscale apartment complex, still under construction as he and his wife moved in. He felt lost as to what to do, reached out to the ADL, and ADL California State Director Nancy Appel helped him craft an email to the landlord. No response was ever received, so they left their mezuzah up. But not everyone is so lucky. State Senator Ben Allen, representing Manhattan Beach, Palos Verdes States, Torrance, other Southern California beach communities, said he and his Jewish caucus colleagues heard from a guy whose homeowner association in San Diego insisted he remove his mezuzah from a condo he had purchased. Rather than deal with the expense of a protracted legal fight, the man complied. "Left him feeling very badly, in tears," said Allen. "It's something I found to be outrageous. I don't have to explain to you a mezuzah is an important expression of our faith. We are obligated as Jews to put a mezuzah on our door. It's part of the Ve'a Havta." First full paragraph of the Shema, of course, said in every evening and morning Jewish prayer service. The bill's backers include the National Association of Social Workers, the Jewish-based social justice agency Bend the Ark, the California Catholic Conference, and the Hindu American Foundation. Appel of the ADL said someone from the latter organization told her earlier this year Hindus also traditionally place religious ornaments on their doors. The mezuzah bill protects the hanging of religious items smaller than 36 by 12 square inches. That'd be quite a large mezuzah. With exceptions for objects that hinder the opening or closing of a door or violate federal, state, or local law or threaten public health or safety. Allen said he doesn't think prohibitions on hanging mezuzahs set by landlords and property managers are born out of anti-Semitism, but they show incredible insensitivity. It's part of living in a diverse multicultural society, he added. Part of it is having awareness and sensitivity to other people's beliefs and letting them put up a mezuzah. In other California Jewish news, the Los Angeles Dodgers will add a statue of legendary Jewish pitcher Sandy Koufax to their stadium. It's part of a $100 million renovation project of the venerable stadium. The statue will be located next to one of Jackie Robinson, the Hall of Fame Dodger and Major League Baseball's first African-American player. The Dodgers revealed all this at a news conference last week, of course. Both of these statues will be in a new plaza beyond the stadium's center field fence. The team will dedicate the Koufax statue during the 2020 season next season. Opened in 1962, beautiful Dodger Stadium is baseball's third oldest stadium these days, behind only Fenway Park in Boston and Wrigley Field in Chicago. Sandy Koufax, known for sitting out the first game of the 1965 World Series to observe Yom Kippur, spent his 12-season career as a member of the Dodgers, the whole of it, first in Brooklyn and then in L.A., where the club relocated in 1958. The great Koufax is widely regarded as one of the best pitchers in all history. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Mark Sarvas is the author of Memento Park, a remarkable novel, recipient of a number of awards. It explores a rediscovered art masterpiece. It's kind of masterpiece itself. I really like the book.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I sound like a fanboy here. I apologize. But...
I'll take it. I appreciate that.
Look, the notion of using art as a kind of a window into a culture and into an experience, and of course, both the Holocaust and then, kind of the whole Hungarian Jewish experience and the denial of Jewish identity. When you invented this painting, you invent the painter too, right? How did you choose? How did you decide how to model them?
Invented, I would say more that I stole the painter and the painting. He is based pretty clearly on a German expressionist painter named Ernst Ludwig Kirchner. And I have borrowed from his biography to contribute to my painter's biography, and the painting in the novel, the Budapest street scene, is based pretty clearly, if you read all the descriptions and then stand in front of Kirchner's Berlin street scene. It's in fact, there are images from that painting that are cut up and reproduced on the cover of the novel. Those images come from this painting. So,
did you get to choose that? A lot of times the covers have no relationship to the author, I'm told.
Well, I was definitely part of the discussion, and I was consulted throughout, and there were some early cover designs which I didn't feel were quite cutting it. And I wasn't sure what to propose because I'm not especially visual. I'm a writer, but I had the idea that, well, let me send the designer this image of the inspiring painting itself, the Berlin street scene. And once I sent that to him, then he got this wonderful idea of these sort of cutout images and using the font in that sort of painted font. I adore the cover. I think he did a wonderful job with it.
Yeah, it's great.
But it was definitely helpful that I sent him along that painting.
In the story, the painting is traded for exit visas to get out of Hungary just before Eichmann comes. And then it's rediscovered. I don't want to give too much away, but now it's this, you know, painting that's worth millions. You already talked about it. I don't think it's a spoiler alert. Of this Budapest street scene. And then it's sort of him dealing with it after that. What is there in that exploration that struck you so much?
Well, so obviously there are a number of twists and turns in the journey of the painting itself that we will not reveal to your listeners. No. But what really animates this book, I was telling my students at UCLA last night as I was teaching a novel revision class, but I always... as I'm revising, I put sort of a key question that encapsulates the whole of the novel, and I type it out and I hang it on my monitor so that when I'm deep in the weeds and I feel like I'm lost, I can always look back at that sentence and reconnect to the book. And for Memento Park, that driving question was, what happens when the past is lost forever, sort of beyond recovery? And the novel, I think, has a great plot and a page-turning narrative, but it's really engaging with these questions of memory and how memory works and, you know, what is sort of the obligation of the newer, the younger generations to know the stories of our parents and grandparents and whether we ask and have those discussions or don't. I'm sure you and all your listeners have seen these recent dismaying statistics that a large percentage of millennials don't know what Auschwitz is. And you know, I'm not dumping on millennials. I'm a big fan, and I think they're the future. But there is a discourse that sort of needs to happen between the generations, keeping these stories, getting them told. And that was a big part of what really drove the writing of this novel.
The Hungarian Jewish experience is kind of unique. And we talked about a little bit at the beginning, but both the occupation comes late and then the destruction is horrible, but many survive and some flee successfully. And then, of course, many are then occupied and live under communists and leave in 1956. It's like a second time. So there's a period in which Judaism is suppressed. How much did that influence what you did? And because although that's a universal story, this recovery of memory and struggle with the past, there's something really quite unique here, isn't there?
Absolutely. And, you know, Hungary was certainly, you know, got the worst of it more than once. Also, a result of maybe making some bad choices and some poor alliances. But as you point out, the Germans came very late into Hungary. It was March of 1944. And they started out in the countryside. If my family had lived out in the countryside, we wouldn't be on this interview. But right. In Budapest, as you say, there were a lot more survivors. And, you know, I was always aware of those parts and pieces of my parents' history, my father's in particular. I had a dim awareness of these things that were going on. But for my father, as growing up, what I heard much more about was the communists and the communist menace. And that was the thing that in some ways animated him even more thoroughly than what had happened during the war. And it was interesting to me as I sat down and I only started this book after my father wasn't alive anymore, because I felt I couldn't really write it with the honesty required if I knew he was going to read it. And to think about the ways in which he had really so thoroughly stepped away from his Jewish identity as this immigrant in America. And I understand that's not uncommon to that generation who came over. Whether it was that they just wanted to completely assimilate forever, or they were so, you know, disappointed and dejected by the events of the war. And I saw that really play out in my father's sort of post-war American history. But that's what, there was a point as I was writing the novel and I realized that my impressions of Hungary were not sort of sufficiently fresh. And so I took a trip back there to just reacquaint myself with the city. And that's when I visited Memento Park of the title, and I realized the same thing that you have here, that it all fit together. Even though the Soviet era seems distinct from what happened during the war, they were much more related than this appeared. And that's how, you know, Memento Park earns its place as the title of the novel, even though that's in some ways a much smaller part of the story.
I want to ask you about your own Jewish kind of rediscovery. You mentioned that earlier. Can you explore that a little?
Sure. It's a little embarrassing, you know, to be admitting this to all of your listeners.
But you're just talking to the rabbi. It's okay. It's not.
That's okay. Well, it was another rabbi who was very helpful to me. And as I was writing this novel, I ran a very well-known literary blog called The Elegant Variation, and one of my readers turned out to be Rabbi David Wolpe, who we became correspondents and then friends. And he was aware that I was writing this book, and at a certain point I told him that I was struggling with this idea, that I was trying to put my character on a journey that I myself had not taken. And it was stymieing me, because I was coming, really facing how deep my ignorance was. And he encouraged me to take an Introduction to Judaism course taught by the American Jewish University up here on Mulholland Drive. It's an 18-week course that is primarily designed for people who are converting for marriage. And so I jumped at it, and I signed up for the course, and they all regarded me, I think, with vague suspicion. They couldn't understand why I was already in the club and yet still coming to all of these classes over this 18-week period. But that was the time where I got what I call my sort of belated Jewish education. And so a wonderful young rabbi named Michael Knopf, who taught the class, and he guided me and gave me much to read. And you know, I'm not going to say that I became overnight a very observant Jew, but I found a connection with a tradition that instinctively I had always recognized and felt and believed was there. And I was able to make those connections stronger, and it became a more integrated part of my life.
Did that help with the book?
Oh, enormously. So
I can now say, look, if you take a deep, you know, basic Judaism, introduction to Judaism course, you'll become an excellent writer too.
I think that's a fair pitch. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean
to. No.
Just had to get that in.
The sections where Matt is talking about the Sabbath and how this notion of the Sabbath really resonates with him. He's speaking for me at that point. Those are all things that I discovered and experienced and felt. You know, I went to my, again, I'm very embarrassed to admit it, but I went to my first Sabbath dinner. I had, you know, this was not part of my childhood, part of my upbringing. And I kept hinting to the rabbi that I would love to see one, and the hints perhaps were too subtle, so I finally invited myself over to his house, and he very graciously accepted and had me in. And many things that work their way into the Sabbath dinner chapter of the novel came from my visit there. So it was a wonderful, wonderful experience from top to bottom for me.
What conclusions can you bring now, kind of in the aftermath of the novel and its success, about that process of knowledge, of memory, and kind of bringing it back to life?
Well, I resist conclusions a little bit. I'm a little suspicious of them. Mm-hmm. You know, the neater the conclusion, the less I trust it. But certainly, you know, I became aware again of how deeply unreliable memory is, you know, how subjective, how individual. And we've all had this experience where, you know, it's the Rashomon effect where three friends recount an incident and it's entirely different. And as I spoke to my father and then my mother and heard these conversations of the past, I think that if there was a conclusion, I had to reconcile myself to the fact that, at least with my father, who was now gone, that I had simply waited too long to talk to him. And I think that part was on me, you know, that I had to sort of take a certain amount of responsibility for whether it was being too self-involved or too busy or too incurious, that I didn't have those conversations. And I understood they were important. They were to make a priority to have them. And I've had a number of conversations with my mother in the wake of publication and have heard all sorts of surprising pieces of family history from her that 20 or 30 years ago she was unable to talk about, and it was too emotional for her to tell me. But now she's in her 80s and this novel has come out and it has loosened something in her. And so we're having those conversations. And so I've certainly concluded that even though the book is done and written, the importance of those conversations is still there.
It's a great book. I strongly urge everybody to read it. Where can people go to find out more about you and about your writing and your work?
Well, certainly I have a website, as all writers do, and I try to keep it reasonably updated. It's just marksarvas.com, MarkSarvas. I'm on the various social medias, but these days if you follow me on Twitter, all you can read about is my political despair, so there's not much literary or Jewish interest to be found there. But the website is a good place to start, and it has links to my books. It also has links to my criticism. I've written book reviews for the New York Times Book Review and many other outlets, and those are up there as well. So,
Mark, thank you for a great visit. We appreciate it.
thank you for having me. This was wonderful. And you know, come back and visit LA soon.
I shall. When we come back here on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this summer and now moving towards the fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vital community and a vibrant one that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Congregation Beit Simcha is open to all throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, north of Ina, on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night at 7315 North Oracle Road. Shabbat evening services are at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them, and next Friday night, Tat Kabbalat Shabbat at 5:30 p.m. for families with young children. A story, song, lots of great stuff. Join us for Shabbat at 7315 North Oracle Road on the west side of Oracle, just north of Ina, and for my Summer Adult Education Academy course, Talk About It, Gossip, Slander, and the Ethics of Speech, on Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, and rich array of summer and fall Adult Education Academy courses, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Or BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona and its fastest growing during its exciting beginning year. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. We will be celebrating our 17th anniversary show. Do not miss this very special edition of Too Jewish, our 889th edition, to be exact. Playout this morning comes from Eitan Katz, his composition Laman Lecha, for your sake, God. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
L'mancha Eloi keinu aseh v'loi lonu riyeh yamid aseinu dalim v'reiki L'mancha Eloi keinu aseh
sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.